Good morning, and welcome to the OBGYN consultation conference call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Russell Shute. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for coming this morning. We have an all-day meeting, a fairly full agenda. The agenda is on your screen, and it is somewhat different from the agenda that you may have received several days ago. The difference being that we've moved forward to prior to lunch, the London Economics presentation on their views regarding the options for incentive rate making. I will remind everyone that this session is being recorded such that we can get an accurate record, also to help me in preparation of a report for the board on the session. So in regard to the recording, you should please identify yourself when you're asking a question and who you're representing. That's just for keeping things straight. And those same rules apply for those who are calling in and asking questions as well. The way we'd like to proceed is to allow the presenters to go through their materials. Everyone does have a PowerPoint. It will be displayed. All the material will be posted on the board's website after this session so that there will be access to electronic, and you can prepare your own hard copies as well. There is a handout of the Power Advisory presentation on the side table, as well as a sign-in sheet. Please sign in and indicate your attendance at some point during the day. No need to queue up now and do it. We'll just do it at your leisure. We do have two breaks scheduled in the presentation period, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Coffee will be provided in the ante room to the side, and we'd like to try to stick to the schedule because there is a lot of material to be covered, and I'm sure there are a lot of questions as well. Regarding the questions and the discussion, we'd like to proceed with the presentations uninterrupted as well as we can. Questions of clarification will be entertained, but leave the questions of substance and discussion to the end of the presentation so we can get through the material, and then we'll take up the discussion at that point. Also, because this isn't a huge group, but it is probably a fairly active group, we'd like to make sure everyone has an equal opportunity, as well as those that are online, to ask questions. So I would request that you ask a question, have one follow-up, and then we'll proceed to the next questioner. And that all depends on the demand coming from the participants. We're fairly flexible here. What we want is a full and active discussion, but we want the ability for everybody to participate. So leave the speeches for later, and we'll try to get through the material as quickly as we can so that we can get to that fulsome discussion. We have on the agenda the capability of going till 5 o'clock, so 4:30 is not a hard deadline. Who knows, we may be done at 3:30, but that very much depends on the discussion and what happens here on the floor and online. As I've said, we will be requesting for those who want to make written submissions to the board on this question and on this consultation. You may make a written submission to the board, and the instructions are on the website as to how to proceed with that. There is no hard and firm deadline on that as yet, but I'm suggesting the end of September for getting those written submissions into the board. That's just because I'm going to be away for 2 weeks. So I didn't want to push anybody, and I don't want to push myself. So we'll proceed in that. I think that gives us about a month after today to prepare whatever needs to be prepared. And I will again advise you that anything that is submitted to board will be posted on the website. So please be cognizant of that. And any other materials that we do receive will also be posted. The board's policy is full disclosure and full and open discussion. So proceed in with that in mind. Now, I'd like to get started with the presentations. And first presentation is by Power Advisory. Mitch Rothman and Bob Yardley are here to make that presentation. It's also be up on the screen, and there is hard copy available at the side table.
Thank you, Rusty, for that introduction. I'm Mitch Rothman, that's Bob Yardley, as Rusty indicated by moving his head. For those people on the phone, I think we have distinctive enough voices that you can figure it out, but we'll try to remember to tell you when we switch off, because this is going to be a bit of a tag team presentation. So let me just start out by thanking Rusty and the board for the opportunity to work on this project. We found it very exciting and challenging, as I'm sure you all do find it very exciting and challenging. And let me also say that we expected, did this report on the expectation that there would be a consultation like this, and that our report is a starting point for discussion rather than our understanding of this is the only right way to do things. It's our understanding that we wanted to put forward some ideas and some conclusions, and we've done that, and we expect a discussion to follow as it is. We assume that most of you have had the opportunity to read the report, and therefore we assume that you are reasonably familiar with it, and we're not introducing anything new in the presentation today. We're essentially going through the report as we have prepared it. Let's see. So that's a table of contents. Just gives you some idea of the sequence of the presentation, and that follows exactly the sequence of chapters of the report. So this is, as I said, we're really just presenting this report. So we were asked to identify and evaluate options for the prescribed nuclear and hydroelectric generation facilities. This is pretty well known. It's a list of the facilities, their in-service dates, and listed capacity. The total capacity is about 9,900 megawatts and provide 45% of Ontario's energy requirements. So these are not inconsequential in the context of the Ontario electricity supply system. What's the whole point of this? The whole point of this has been that the Ontario Energy Board has consistently, with respect to its regulatory mandate, felt that incentive regulation mechanisms, an IRM, is preferred, their preferred way of going about regulating. And they've done that, of course, with respect to the distribution utilities and transmission, and have talked about doing it with respect to Ontario Power Generation's operations. But they only regulate the rates for a part of Ontario Hydro, Ontario Power Generation's, Ontario Hydro, only a part of Ontario Power Generation's total fleet, which is the designated assets. So the purpose of this report is, as I said, to present a starting point that stakeholders can use for their discussions. And Bob is going to take over from here.
Okay, thank you, Mitch. This, I think my voice is distinctive from Mitch's. I won't use my Boston accent, although I'm capable of doing that for entertainment. I'm going to just spend over the next few slides some history of the regulation and the prices, which many of you are familiar with. I noticed we have 33 slides, so I didn't realize that until I saw the table of contents, so I think we can go through this fairly quickly. Restructuring was set in motion, as you know, with the Energy Competition Act in 1998, with the market opening on April 1st, 2002. And the prices were effectively set at that time at 3.8 cents per kilowatt hour through a document referred to as the Market Power Mitigation Agreement to make sure that OPG was not able to exercise market power given its dominant position in the market. These prices were in effect until 2005 when Ontario Regulation 5305 came into effect. And at that point, the prices for nuclear and hydroelectric production were distinct, $49.50 for nuclear production and $33 per megawatt hour for hydro production, with hydro production above 1,900 megawatt hours per hour receiving the market price. So there was some incentive implicit there to increase production. That pricing structure operated like a contract for differences, and the difference between the fixed prices and the HOEP was credited to customers through the global adjustment, and that began this sort of relationship between the HOEP and the global adjustment. And those were to remain in place for at least 3 years. And then, in theory, I can point at Mitch's computer and something happens, but there we go. Did I go too far? Here we go. I wasn't sure I believed that was going to happen. So. Around that same time in 2005, the province of Ontario entered into a memorandum of understanding with OPG, and it was at this point really that the concepts of IRM were raised to another level. And that's, I think there's a pattern here where we can see a continual movement toward incentive concepts in the regulation of OPG. And this was one significant step in that continuum. So there were several concepts introduced at this point. The notion that OPG was to operate facilities efficiently and cost effectively as possible. Now, I mean, that's not unique to incentive regulation. Cost of service regulation tries to achieve some of these same objectives. And that's just a general thought as we go through and talk about incentive regulation. You always want to keep in mind that the current system of cost of service regulation also has incentives implicit within it. We want to focus on really those differences. The MOA also indicated that OPG was to reduce its exposure to nuclear generation investments. I think it was thinking about the refurbishments that would be coming at some time, and operate with a high degree of safety, as any nuclear operator must constantly be diligent with respect to its safety obligations. And the MOA also indicated that OPG was to see continuous improvement in the nuclear generation business, and also with respect to internal services. There are fair, when you look at the rates for OPG, there's a meaningful or significant portion is reflected by internal corporate services that are allocated to the business units. Along those same lines, in terms of, if you think about the notion of continuous improvement, a common practice is to benchmark against other units. In this case, there are CANDU units throughout the world, and the the province directed OPG to benchmark both against all of the CANDU units and the North American units, and to establish for internal purposes sort of 3 to 5 year performance targets. So the message was clear at that point that the province expected OPG to really be focusing on its both near-term and longer-term performance. In 2005, again at that same time, the OEB opened a policy consultation docket, and many, if not all of you, submitted comments and participated in that docket. And at the outcome of that docket, the board formally endorsed incentive regulation as its preferred approach, but recognized that there needed to be some transition before you can get to an incentive regulatory approach. Incentive regulation in almost all cases begins with a cast-off point or a starting point that's based on cost of service. And the mechanism makes most sense if people have some understanding of what the underlying costs are. You wouldn't want to I'm going to speak generally now, not with respect to OPG at all, but if there was a sense that there was a lot of room for improvement, you might be fairly cautious when you introduced incentive regulation. If you sensed that a company, a utility, had taken aggressive actions over the last several years leading up to incentive, you might take a different approach with respect to incentive regulation and some of the targets. And the notion really is that there should be some fairness. You wouldn't want to overly reward at the beginning of an incentive regulation process the utility, but you wouldn't want to put them in a position where, because they were already operating efficiently, they had no chance of really making significant improvements. And I think you've seen some of that on the distribution side with the different productivity and stretch factors for the different utilities. So that's the basic concept. So in order to get to that point, it's important for all stakeholders to be comfortable with the level of costs. There is another more practical element, which is that incentive regulation also requires special studies to come up, if it's a price cap approach, to come up with a productivity offset or an inflation factor. The productivity offset studies tend to be fairly complex and subject to a great deal of discussion about the methodology and the advantages and disadvantages, and numerous data issues are introduced as well, which I understand and I know has been an issue in Canada. And finally, as part of that consultation docket, the OEB did go a step and define, as you see on the screen, a concept of efficiency. Noting in particular that introducing the notion of sustainability, it doesn't do consumers much good if efficiency gains are short-term and can't be sustained. So there may be some investments required. You wouldn't want a utility to take short-term actions, the easy stuff, without also having in mind that it's in consumers' long-term interest to make some investments, to look at the business processes in with a longer-term perspective as well, and to have an eye on those longer-term efficiency gains as well. So the board recognized that by highlighting the importance of sustainable improvements, and also made the tie to quality of service, which most regulatory agencies do when they enter into incentive regulation, so that the utility isn't pursuing efficiencies at the expense of reliability of service or other attributes that consumers care about. I'm now on slide 7, which I'll mention. I should mention that occasionally for people on the phone. This slide 7 has just a brief history of the prices. I won't read through this, but it refers to, in the last two rows of the matrix, these first two cost of service proceedings. The first one in 2008, well, with rates that became effective in 2008, focused on the cost of capital, nuclear O&M expenses, the Bruce lease and other revenues, variance in deferral accounts, which are a constant in every proceeding. And they also adopted some mitigation due to a weak economy, so there was an implicit credit, if you will, to customers just to reflect the state of the economy, not really tied to costs from what I understand. And the Hydroelectric Incentive Mechanism, or HIM, I don't know if you all refer to it as HIM, but that was introduced in the 2008 proceeding as well. Now, there were other proposals in that proceeding. There was one in particular that we cited in the report. I assume and I believe it was OPG recommended a two-part rate design, which is fairly common for capital-intensive utilities, and certainly that's the case here. That proposal was rejected by the board. My sense is what they felt that they would have a greater incentive to increase production if all of the fixed costs were at risk. In other words, with a one-part rate, your recovery of your fixed costs, including the return on and return of capital, is exposed to the volume that you're able to produce. So it is fairly risky for capital-intensive facilities. But it also provides, on the other side, an opportunity to earn a significant return if production is equal to or exceeds the levels that might have been used when rates were established in that calculation. The second proceeding, cost of service proceeding, was in 2011, and at that time there was a lot of focus on the HIM, and OPG had done fairly well from a financial standpoint as a result of the initial incentive mechanism, and there was a sense that some sharing was appropriate. The discussion of the HIM also got into the relationship, the embedded relationship between the incentive mechanism, the hydro incentive mechanism, and surplus base load generation conditions. Fairly complex topic, probably among the most complex topics that we examined, and certainly in the hydro area. And I don't know that everyone was satisfied at the end of that hearing, but the board, as part of its order, indicated, directed OPG to focus on the HIM in its next filing, examining benefits to ratepayers. There's this relationship between the HOEP and GA, which means that the incentive that drives OPG to produce as much power during peak periods, some of that ends up flowing back through the GA. So the incentive isn't quite, from the consumer's perspective, the benefits of operating the pump generating station during peak periods aren't as significant as might be indicated by the mechanism. And so that's why the board is interested in I believe, moving as close toward a mechanism where it's clear what the benefits to ratepayers are from the incentive mechanism. The board asked OPG to focus on that interaction with SBG, with the SBG being the surplus baseload generation conditions, and to propose any potential alternatives. As you've read through these proceedings and some interim proceedings, you'll see a lot of discussion of variance and deferral accounts. There are a fair number of variance and deferral accounts. It's fairly common in Canada relative to the U.S., for example. But in this case, I think it's quite large. I mean, there are variances on the recovery of variances, which I thought was a new concept. So, and the development of new nuclear is also treated separately. And those are reviewed in every proceeding. So with that, I'll turn it over to Charles. I'm going to turn it back to Mitch, not just because you handed me this note. Don't speed up next time.
I'll give it to him.
We're We're at slide 8 out of 36, and we're 25 minutes in, so we'll try to go a little faster. And this next, as I said before, we kind of assume that you know most of this stuff, so I'm going to go through it pretty quickly. But I wanted to start out with the basic question that is almost not discussed in the report, and that is, if you're going to do an incentive rate mechanism for OPG, do you do one or do you do two? Is there something you might want to apply to all of the prescribed assets, or do you need separate mechanisms for hydroelectric and nuclear? And it seemed pretty clear, as I say, it's not much discussed in the report, and I think because we would all pretty much agree that it makes sense to do separate ones for nuclear and hydroelectric. They have very different kinds of cost structures. They have very different levels of actual performance, which is what we're about to review right now. They have different prices. So whereas with a distribution utility, you basically have one rate structure, one set of prices, with OPG's prescribed assets, you have two prices, two cost structures, two levels of performance, two actually different operating structures. The operating structures between hydroelectric assets and the nuclear assets are very different. They face different markets. The hydroelectric assets can, at least to some extent, have their output shaped. The nuclear assets, very difficult to shape that output. So there are very different approaches here, and we thought it was a foregone conclusion that you needed two incentive mechanisms. That gets to the next question, which is, are there any precedents? Do we know where we can find an example of an incentive rate-making approach to new generation only, hydroelectric generation only, nuclear generation only? And that's very rare. In the United States, those utilities that operate nuclear either operate it in a market or they are vertically integrated utilities that are regulated. So they have nuclear operations, thermal operations, hydroelectric operations. They probably own transmission. They probably own distribution. And there, the regulators kind of don't have much choice but to apply regulation to their entire operation. They apply typically a cost of service. So when we looked at this issue, looked at this question, we said we need to think about how you would apply different mechanisms to hydroelectric operations and to nuclear operations, and think about how you would adapt those appropriately to this unique question. So we looked at, you want to start out with, let's understand how the nuclear operations, how the hydroelectric operations are performing now. Where did they stand? And fortunately, we were able to start out with the Scott Madden reports that had been filed in the 2008 proceeding, and they had a great deal of information on the cost and performance of the nuclear plants, and we can this first slide, the first data, these are data from within OPG, and just tell us what did OPG do in its annual information form. And it suggests that the nuclear capability factor, the unit capability factor, which is an aggregate measure, has been an aggregate for the company as a whole, fell from 2008 to 2010. There are various reasons for that, including vacuum building outages at both Pickering and Darlington. They may not explain all of the drop, but just in general, we're seeing that there's been not a huge drop, but it's not inconsequential to have a unit capability factor fall from 83.7 to 80.1%. Now we look at the Scott Madden benchmarking report. The performance can be readily summarized, and if you read the Toronto Star, you saw this sentence quoted: the Pickering A and B plants had among the worst, and on some measures the worst, operating records among the plants in these databases. That caught their attention. And did get some publicity, so I don't need to go over it very much. This chart is again from the report. This is an intention to have a graphic display that gives us some color coding of how are these nuclear plants performing. The red coding means you're in the bottom quartile. It's pretty clear from this that the Pickering plants are in the bottom quartile. The Darlington plants are on some measures in the top quartile, and none of them are they in the bottom quartile. Some measures in the top, others in the second, and none are they in the bottom quartile. So it's pretty clear that there's a distinct difference between the performance of the Darlington plants and the performance of the Pickering plants. Remember also, it's important to remember, that these data are from 2008. These are two-year average forest loss rates, three-year average on the generating costs. These are from the Scott Madden report. Those are the data they used. And so it's important to remember that these data are not the most recent data potentially available. In the report, as you may remember, I got some data from the IAEA using energy availability factor data, and I compared those across time and across Bruce Nuclear. They suggest that the performance of the Ontario power generation plants has not improved significantly from 2008 to 2010. Let's see. And this we continue. The other major piece of information we had from the Scott Madden report that I thought we could reproduce here, this is their headcounts. These are their performance in terms of staffing. And these are normalized data. That is, these are the per unit, per generating unit counts for staff. And you'll see that Pickering A looks pretty bad. One of the reasons for Pickering A looking pretty bad is that, again, these are normalized data, which means it is divided by the number of units. Pickering A was designed for four units. It only has two operating, and therefore it suffers by comparison in these data. Nonetheless, we look at Pickering B, which does have four units operating, and compared to the lowest quartile, it's almost twice the total number of people, and so does Darlington have the same, almost twice, and are well above the mean of the median in both cases. And if we look at essentially the largest of these, the plant operations and management and support, and you'll see that here, again, we're well above the data from other operations. I think that's the end of this, and back over to Bob for the hydroelectric facilities.
Okay. In terms of the hydro facilities, the pump generating station is really the key resource from an incentive perspective. It helps restrain the HOEP, so it's not only are they reacting to the HOEP in terms of deciding when to pump and when to produce, but it actually influences, and that's in fact the main point of operating, and that's the benefit provided to consumers. Running it during peak prices helps restrain what would otherwise be a larger increase in prices that consumers would pay. It also is used to provide some other ancillary services, and I mentioned before the complicating operating factors introduced by surplus baseload generation and the need to spill water, which is not an ideal way to use that facility. So these roles do put strain on that on the pump generation station, and as a result, it requires more frequent maintenance. The facilities, like many hydro facilities throughout the world, are old. They have a long life expectancy, as long as you maintain them well. That's an important concept, and OPG has an asset management program because you certainly don't want to do anything to save money in the short term and do anything that harms the ability of those assets to be around for a long time and operate when they're most needed. And in fact, there's no evidence that OPG has operated in any way that compromises the reliability of the assets. The performance has been good. They've experienced high availability factors. and costs have really not been an issue to date in any of the regulatory proceedings. But again, the surplus baseload generation seems to be a particular challenge and likely to be one over the next couple of years as more baseload generation comes online. And that's it. I'll go now. The next few slides, thank you, whoever did that. The next few slides are pretty familiar to all of you that have worked with incentive regulation before. As I said, IRM is just an alternative to cost of service regulation. I won't repeat the goals, but the approaches are pretty common, either price cap or revenue cap in most cases. And there are two types of incentives in general in the utility industry, broad-based, which look at a broad range of activities and bring them within the same umbrella. That provides the utility with the much more flexibility in terms of where they seek out and the investments they make to achieve efficiencies. There are targeted incentives as well that focus on a particular activity that a regulator is concerned about. It may be a new policy objective. So you can use the two in combination, but it's important to have in mind those two separate concepts. In any incentive mechanism, there are a lot of implementation challenges. The proceedings, as you know, tend to be fairly complex. There are methodological challenges. There are data and measurement challenges. You're measuring performance. It's not always obvious how that performance should be measured. Parties will propose different measurements. Wherever you have benchmarks, there's a discussion about whether or not if you're comparing benchmarks work in a couple of different ways. You can compare a utility's performance to its own performance in during some historical period. At least there you're looking at apples and apples for the most part in terms of the data you may be looking at, or it can be fixed. But where you're benchmarking against other units and other companies, that introduces a lot of measurement questions in terms of whether those comparisons are really viable. And as I mentioned, the difficulty of coming up with the productivity studies before, it's also important that you not design a system that requires the entire business operations of a utility to be restructured just in order to produce data to measure an incentive. So there has to be some practical element. No system is perfect. Some judgment is required. I think Mitch really touched on this in terms of IRM for generation. We didn't find a lot of examples. There are some targeted incentives, but you don't see too many broad-based generation incentives focused on an entire portfolio of assets. At least we didn't find any. We'd certainly be interested to learn more about other incentives that may be available. As you know, rather than try to improve the efficiency of the generation sector by more aggressive regulation, many jurisdictions essentially deregulated the generation segment, and as a result, there have been tremendous efficiency improvements realized through market mechanisms. So that's a classic experiment, if you will, where regulators were frustrated with, especially coming out of some of the nuclear development in the 70s, frustrated with their inability to, with costs going up and not feeling like they could do very much about it, except conduct very lengthy and costly prudence reviews after the fact. The next two slides, we thought it was important before we got to the options to have some criteria just to bounce those, to measure those options against. These are the criteria that we came up with. They're pretty, I think, common sense. Obviously, you want whatever the mechanism is to promote efficiency. Customer bills are the most important thing at the end of the day, not just in the near term, but over time. Since OPG has significant financial and financing requirements, it's imperative, as in any regulatory system, that they be able to access capital on reasonable terms. So the mechanism should preserve OPG's financial integrity. And especially with in the case where we're talking about regulating nuclear assets, nothing should be done that impairs potential safety of the safe operation of those assets. And finally, you want to preserve the value for future use, which we've addressed now a couple of times. And then the final set of criteria, our implementation criteria, since it's we're in the regulated world here, it's important that there be accountability and transparency. Consumers have a significant interest in understanding the prices that they pay, and the board has an obligation to be able to communicate its decisions effectively as well. There's always a chance that when a group gets together to design a regulatory mechanism, things never get simpler. They always get more complex. I think we've seen that in other industries as well. When you do that, there is a potential, if the rules are extraordinarily complex, for there to be gaming. It's nice to try to anticipate that up front. Sometimes that's why these things go through multiple iterations. People see how it works the first time, they do their best, and then adjustments are made. And finally, you want the system to be relatively easy to implement.